This podcast examines issues on violence driven by gender inequality, a profound and widespread global health problem that is likely to have personally touched the lives of our listeners. Listen with care and compassion, and please talk to someone should anything come up for you while listening to this episode. For more resources, email svri at svri.org.
It is possible to do this ethically and safely, because if women feel safe, they're more likely to disclose something like an experience of abuse.
You're listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast from the SVRI. I am Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I am Angelica Pino. Our vision is to see a world free of violence against women and violence against children. And in this podcast, we'll learn how to make that vision a reality.
In today's episode, we're finding out how to conduct research on violence against women ethically.
Hi, I'm Nancy Glass. I'm a professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Nursing in Baltimore, Maryland. In my role at Hopkins, I primarily focus on research, and that means that I collaborate with multiple teams around the world to really study how best to prevent and respond to gender-based violence. I have also started and continue to focus on areas where there's been significant conflict, humanitarian emergencies, and trying to integrate strategies to prevent and respond to violence in those settings.
Nancy is joined on the panel by Claudia Garcia Moreno from the World Health Organization.
I am now leading a unit addressing the needs of populations in vulnerable situations in the Department of Sexual and Reproductive Health and Research at WHO. But I've also been leading WHO's work going back more than 25 years. I started the work on violence against women in the mid-90s, shortly after Beijing Conference on Women, to bring attention to violence against women as a public health issue, and also worked in my early days in WHO on integrating a gender perspective across the work of the organization and developing the first gender mainstreaming policy.
And we'll also meet Yandisa Skoyia, Special Scientist in the Gender and Health Research Unit at the South African Medical Research Council.
I work as a researcher. I've been doing research on gender-based violence in South Africa. But in the last 10 years or so, we've shifted our focus after we've really had a good understanding of what really drives this violence in South Africa and also in other countries. But also I've been involved since, I think, 2006 with, you know, ethics committees in South Africa, including that of the SAMRC. But also I've served on the National Health Research Ethics Council, which is the council that really registers all the ethics committees in South Africa and really produces guidelines and guidance and continued advice to ethics committees. But in the last few years as well, I have been asked by research groups to be an independent ethics advisor for the, you know, in their studies.
Research is a fundamental part of addressing violence against women, because we need to learn what works in order to create effective interventions. But there are inherent risks involved in this type of research, not only to study participants, but to researchers too.
When you're working with vulnerable women, many of whom are traumatized by their experiences, ethics must necessarily form the backbone of any study. Yandisa tells us about the key issues that need to be considered.
The researchers really need to be guided by the question of social value of the research. You know, how the research that they, you know, are doing is going to be potentially beneficial to the, you know, research participants, especially women that they are involving in their studies, so that we can ensure that the research that we do really has that social value and benefit to the research participants, the women, but also, you know, to indirectly to the whole community. But also, you know, we have guidance, you know, ethics guidance that has been developed by researchers in the field. So there is, you know, importance of adhering to those guidelines. And also, I think the you know, ensuring that the work that we do, the research that we do, is really well thought through, in that all the risks that are potential in that study have been thought about. And really, the design of the study itself has measures that are built into the design that will ensure that they reduce quite significantly the risk that you could potentially, as a researcher, pose to the research participants. And one of the ways of doing that is to ensure that you write a good research proposal where you really articulate what the foreseeable risks are in the study that you're going to do, and have that subjected to, you know, an ethics review by you are in a country where there's or in an institution where there's an ethics committee, then you have your research being reviewed by those committees. There are instances where you find that you're working in a setting where there's no IRB, and you have to find innovative ways of capacitating the community, you know, so that the community or the stakeholders there can really be the people who will then be capacitated to look at your protocol as people who really know the context, and they can be able to see whether the study that you are proposing will indeed be ethically engaged and safe for the people that you want to talk to. And also, I think that there's the importance of really ensuring that, you know, if you're going to work in a particular setting, you must invest in that setting. You need to understand the setting itself first, so that you can understand, you know, cultural appropriate ways of obtaining informed consent in that particular area, so that you can understand how do you go about with community entry in that particular community. And also, if, for example, we oftentimes work in really patriarchal societies where, for example, women and girls, you know, are not expected to consent to research on their own and all those things. So you need to be able to understand that so that your research does not pose a risk to the research participant that you want to talk to. I mean, this speaks really to a question of respect for communities. And the investment I was talking about, it also includes ensuring, you know, a proper community engagement, where even other people will advocate for that. When you are starting your research, you need to really start engaging with the community, you know, as soon as possible, and ensuring that you have strategies like community advisory boards that you form, so that the people within that community who know the community much better can really advise you on ways of doing research in that community that will not be posing a risk to the people who will be participating in your research. And in those community advisory boards have been really helpful in the research that we've done in South Africa and elsewhere.
One study which serves as a shining example of this strong focus on ethics is the WHO Multi-Country Study on Women's Health and Domestic Violence Against Women. Claudia coordinates the initiative and tells us how it came about.
Well, I think it's easy to forget how marginalized violence against women was, you know, 25 years ago as an issue. All the information on the issue was coming from women's non-governmental organizations. There was really hardly any data, particularly from low and middle income countries. So in 96, at the very beginning of 96, just after Beijing, we brought together a very small group of women's organizations and some epidemiologists and sort of discussed what could WHO usefully contribute to help this field move forward. And one of the things that was identified among several others was to develop a study that would, you know, be methodologically sound and would be scientifically credible to governments. And so we embarked on this study, and I think I would highlight a couple of things that I think were very innovative. We, from the very beginning, established this as a partnership between women's organizations working on violence against women that we recognized as kind of experts on the issue and researchers. We didn't want this to be just an academic exercise where we developed a protocol with researchers and then, you know, landed it in countries. We really wanted this to be a partnership. And that was really hard because there was really very little precedent for this in WHO. And to establish those partnerships required quite a lot of dialogue between the two parties to, on the one hand, bring a better understanding of research and why it was important to the women's organizations that kind of felt like, well, we know it's a problem, you know, why do we need to do all this research? And to the researchers to acknowledge and partners, see as equal partners, the women. And then we also established kind of an advisory group that brought in the policymakers. So on the one hand, the study set out to gather data in a comparable way across a set of countries that we deliberately wanted to be geographically and culturally diverse. We wanted to understand, on the one hand, the global magnitude and also to understand what were some of the key drivers and how universal these were across different countries and cultures, and what were some of the perhaps more specific drivers that were very context specific. So the study set out to develop a methodology that would be suitable for different cultures and that we could generate this comparable data. So it had, like, on the one hand, the objective of obtaining the data on, you know, the prevalence, the magnitude, the nature of different forms of violence, but with a strong focus on partner violence, because that had been identified as one of the more perhaps hidden forms of violence against women that weren't really being spoken about, and also sexual violence. We wanted to look at what were some of the health impacts, because it was thought that this was a really good entry point to engage with countries and less threatening than, let's say, a human rights approach. Although from the beginning, we also clearly framed this as a gender inequality and human rights issue. And we also wanted data on what were the key drivers and, you know, what were protective factors. And then we had another section on data on what we called, for want of a better word, coping strategies. You know, what do women do? Where do they seek help? Who do they talk to? What kind of response do they get? So it had those kind of four broad areas of data gathering.
So guidelines were created to inform the ethical considerations of this research initiative. Can you tell us about them and the impact of these guidelines still today?
We have to acknowledge that we were building on work that had been started by Lori Heise, who had organized two meetings prior to to us starting on the study that brought together some of the few people that were doing research on violence against women in low and middle income countries to just share their experiences, what were some of the challenges they were facing in the field. And out of these discussions, one of the things that was identified as very critical was the issue of, you know, how do we ensure that this research isn't putting women at any increased risk and that it's carried out ethically? So we brought together people to share their experiences around what were some of the ethical challenges they had faced in doing this research, particularly in contexts where, you know, we have very little limited services available, where the prevalence was very high and where the issue was still really not well acknowledged or talked about. And so out of these discussions came the recommendations on how to do this research ethically and safely. And we identified, if I remember correctly, around 8 issues that we considered were very important. Firstly, making sure that the safety of both respondents and interviewers would be the paramount, you know, we would not do anything that would in any way jeopardize the safety of either the respondents or the interviewers. Making sure that we had things in place, mechanisms in place to ensure that this happened included things like, for example, making sure that we had like what we called a dummy questionnaire so that if anyone walked in the room when you were in the middle of doing an interview, you could change the subject to questions on reproductive health or, you know, some other more, you know, like women's health issues. Guaranteeing the absolute privacy before conducting any interview. We heard terrible stories of, you know, women being interviewed on, you know, domestic abuse in front of their abusive partners, which of course is not going to be very helpful in terms of disclosure and could potentially put women at increased risk of violence. And we went as far as saying that no child above 2 years of age could be present at any moment, because there was a concern that, you know, some children might just say something inadvertently that could you know, put the women at risk. So the issue of absolute privacy was important, making sure that services were available so that if you identified someone who was in distress or who was, you know, in danger, you know, you had a possibility to refer them somewhere. And one of the challenges that we found with this was that not in all places the services were available. We emphasized also that the selection and the training of interviewers was very important. And this was really interesting because we had to come up with, you know, ways of identifying people that maybe had the right training or the right skills, but just didn't have the right attitudes. So the process of selecting who would be the interviewers, and also very rigorous training around understanding of gender inequality and understanding of the dynamics of violence, you know, the very delicate balance of being empathetic and supportive without committing yourselves or without in any way putting yourself in a situation where you had to solve problems that were beyond you. And I think this is something that also can be tricky. And through the process of the study, which took place in 10, 11 countries initially, but has since, I mean, the same methodology has now been used very widely, and other surveys like the demographic and health surveys now use the same WHO recommendations whenever they implement the domestic violence module. And it sort of has become the gold standard for IRBs for research in this area. So I think that the ethical and safety guidelines were a really good output of the study, and they continue to be used. And we are in the process of updating these with the SVRI, taking into account that there's now a lot more technology-based surveys than there was at the time. You know, we started these guidelines when we were still using pen or pencil and paper, and so we are in the process of updating these guidelines.
A lot has changed for researchers during the COVID-19 pandemic, with many having to move their research online. And remote research presents its own unique challenges. Nancy is a world leader in creating evidence-based online tools to support violence against women survivors. She tells us about this work.
I've been very lucky to have worked with a great team in the U.S., but also around the world, in thinking through strategies to use technology to improve access to survivors, primarily focused on women in abusive relationships and don't have resources to planning for their safety. I'm really interested in how women think about safety in their relationships, what strategies they use to improve the safety for themselves and their family and their children, and then what are the barriers to really implementing those strategies. We know globally that for many women, access to skilled trauma-informed care can be quite limited. But we know women are doing multiple things every day to improve their safety, and especially in situations where leaving a relationship is really not something they want or an option. So we started to think about how technology, especially as it has evolved now to primarily smartphones and apps, how we could use that technology to provide a evidence-based. And when we talk about evidence-based, I really mean informed by survivors and advocates who are working in the field on a day-to-day basis with survivors, and how to make that more inclusive. So expanding to reach diverse gender identities and just thinking about women who and others who, you know, don't have access to traditional mental health services or advocacy services. And so we know that it's not a solution in and of itself. We see it as a resource that can be integrated into our comprehensive approach to prevention and response. We didn't develop the MyPlan app, is what it's called. We didn't develop that as a replacement for the amazing skilled providers around the world, but as a tool that can be used by providers when they're working with their clients around safety, but also for women who may not have access to or not sure about resources or have their own biases about reaching out around stigma and shame. So it is a tool. It's not a standalone resource for women. It should be integrated into programming.
Even as lockdowns become less frequent and the pandemic passes, it is likely remote research is going to become much more common. So what advice can Nancy give to researchers on how to design an ethical remote research study on violence against women?
I think for all the work we're doing, especially integrating technology, ethics has to be in the forefront. And the first thing is to recognize that technology may not be for all survivors. We do know that abusive partners are very skilled at surveillance of their partner, and technology is one of the strategies they use for surveillance. They monitor the phones, they monitor passwords, they monitor all types of access to resources. So really thinking through as a team and with input from survivors and advocates about safety and for the user and also for the provider. So we think about key components of passwords and dummy passwords that when a password is forced to be entered, it leads the user to, in Kenya, for example, a recipe page. So really thinking through and getting advice from survivors about how to ethically integrate technology into their services. And I think also for researchers, really thinking through, you know, where do women access resources? Can we integrate these tools in programs where women are already seeking services, even when they go to schools, when they go to the healthcare clinics? It needs to be thought through in a way that the primary issue is safety and security for the survivor, and that they have a say in if this is the right mechanism for delivering research surveys, for delivering services, and really thinking through with the team on the ground around access, around security and safety, around privacy. Really, a big thing that we think through is a privacy policy. How do we collect data? How do we store data? Who has access to the data? We're very clear on our app that we don't store data on the app. And so we can't track use. We can't monetize the use of our app. If we're doing research, we have a completely separate system from MyPlan app where the user consents to having and knows that they're in a research study. So really creating separate systems where, you know, you're not storing someone's data that could be accessed and used in a way that they have not consented to. I think for more and more that's a big issue that's coming up for people who are being asked to provide information through online surveys or through apps.
Although there are additional considerations for remote research, the fundamental principles are the same. But how do the ethical considerations for violence against women research differ from researching other sensitive topics? How does the potentially threatening and often traumatic nature of the subject matter make things more challenging?
I would highlight three things. One is the taboo nature of the topic. And I think one of the things that surprised us the most when we did the first round of the multi-country study, and this is now 25 years ago when the issue was much less talked about, much less visible, was that between half to even two-thirds of the women in some of the sites told us at the end of the interview that this was the first time they had talked to anyone about this experience. And that was really quite, I mean, we knew it was taboo and we knew it was silent, but this was really quite very high numbers of women who had never talked about it to anyone, some that were even not recognizing it before they had started to be asked these kind of questions. I think the safety is the most important one, that, you know, we know that if an abusive controlling husband or partner finds out that she's been talking to other people about this, this could potentially lead to an escalation of the violence or to violence or even to murder. And although I would say that in general, we have had very few reports of this actually happening. I think this is one of the big concerns in this field. And one of the recommendations that we have added when we did the adaptation for the interventions research was that we need to also start to incorporate measuring and monitoring of harms, of potential harms to the research. Because we don't have, I mean, we have some anecdotal reports, but we don't have a lot of hard data on have there been actual harms from this type of research, what type of harms, etc. So I think this is something we have now identified as needing more work. The third issue is that for a lot of the interviewers, listening to some of these stories was very difficult, especially when sometimes you feel that you would like to do more, you would like to help. And, you know, we were very clear that you're not there as counselors, you're not there, you know, that's why we have these referral services, but you need to be very clear about what your role is and not overstep those boundaries. So we found that working with the interviewers, with the field staff, on debriefing, on making sure that they also had some kind of support. That was another important issue. You know, how do you safeguard the mental health of interviewers? How do you ensure that they don't feel overwhelmed by some of the stories they are listening to? And then the last thing I will mention is one of the challenges we found was that in one of the countries we were working in initially, there were no services. There were no NGOs specialized in domestic violence. There were no, you know, trained providers. So we had a big dilemma, you know, and what we ended up doing in that situation was that we got additional funding to train the community health workers, the lady health visitors, that were really just focused on family planning, to give them some training in crisis counseling and, you know, knowing what to do and, you know, and linking up with some hospital or somewhere where if the situation was really serious, we could they could refer. But so we had to set up this kind of new system that didn't exist in a way through this additional training. And it was challenging, but I think it ended up being a positive thing because after the study ended, these women were still there in the communities where we had worked with the skills that they had acquired, and they were able to continue using them, obviously. And it also raised the awareness of the need for these kind of services.
Now we have a sense of how this research differs from other sensitive topics. Let's find out about the impact of socioeconomic settings. Jandisa says doing research on violence against women in communities where resources are constrained is more ethically challenging than in higher income settings.
Here in South Africa, in the studies that we're doing in the informal settlements or the slum areas, you would really be going into it, or even in rural areas, you go into the research, you know, wanting to investigate about gender-based violence or sexual violence or, you know, a related topic, but you get there and you are confronted by, in your thinking and design of the study, you had thought that, for example, that you will, when you find someone who needs a referral, for example, to a professional, you realize that there are no services around that, you know, are accessible to the people that you, you know, in that particular community, or the services that are there are really not of good quality. And you know, for example, that, you know, if you assess the services themselves, you see that they are not able to provide, you know, services in a satisfactory manner. So you get to be challenged by those issues. And also in some areas you get in there, you see that there's really abject poverty, lots of ill health and adversity really in the communities, and not necessarily related to the topic that you have come to research about. But you can see around, and people, as much as you are interviewing them about their own experiences, you know, of violence, for example, but they are more keen to talk about the other issues that are more pressing in their lives. And they talk about, you know, not having, for example, identity documents because they can't afford to travel 100 or so kilometers to town to access, you know, the Home Affairs Department. So there are many other challenges that relate to their socioeconomic status. So you get to be confronted with those issues. But one of the ways that we've done, because we in the research that we do as researchers, we often say to write in our proposals and also to the ethics committees to say that we will refer people that we that report or show distress because of participating in the study to local services, public health services, and all that. But sometimes when you get to those communities, like I said, we don't find those services to be optimal, and so if for example your study has good funding, then what we have done, for example, in the work that we did in the informal settlements, was to create what we called an ethics fund, where we were then knowing that it was outside the scope of the study, but we couldn't let people whom we could see that they really needed immediate help with other things. Then we were able to give them some money to go to travel to town to get to attend to more pressing issues that they were faced with. Also, in another study that I'm an ethics advisor in rural Mpumalanga, another province here, which is a very poor community, and all that. When we got there and we understood the community better, we realized that there's a big problem that relates to their living conditions. And then in the study itself, because it was well-funded, we were able to employ a full-time social worker who dealt with these issues, even though they were not directly related to the study, but they were able to be referred a research assistant who will refer them to that social worker to assess the situation of the people. And the social worker, because is a professional, is able then to link with social workers in the big city. And then that's when we really were comfortable as researchers that we're doing something positive in that community.
Before we get our dose of optimism, I found it fascinating to hear about the work Nancy does to protect women using support technology. Let's find out about the My Plan app that Nancy and her team developed and how it benefits survivors.
So we have, of course, built in a quick exit button. So just at the top of the page, hit here and it will go right to the Google or right to whatever browser you connect it to. That's built in. And then we have trained, we have information before our key thing, before anybody enters the MyPlan app, we have a discussion on the onboarding about, is this the right resource for them? Is their partner savvy at tracking them? Here's some strategies around safely using the MyPlan app. And that talks about your browser history, how to remove your browser history. But it also says, hey, if your partner sees your app open and they want to know what it is, and it's password protected, put in this dummy passcode, and it will then automatically direct you to, every group has said something different. In Kenya, they thought it would be good just to send them to a recipe page, something that's not interesting to the partner, and will just hopefully stop the discussion there. That's also why we called it My Plan. It could be recipes, it could be menstrual cycle, it could be your schedule, it could be all kinds of things. And so women can then think through how do they explain it? In the U.S., we have it go to a list of women's health services. I think it's very important not to talk about in anywhere that's visible of the app or advertisement that it's about partner violence or violence against women. So thinking through with your partners about how do you label it, the language you use, if you're interrupted, how to leave the app quickly, how to minimize the tracking. It's not always possible. It's not 100% proof that they can't still track you, because people are very savvy. But we really want the user to be able to think through, is this the right resource for them? Maybe not use it on their phone, use it on a friend's phone, use it on another family member's phone, use it at work. The other thing is, I think, really important, and certainly in US and other settings, where if a person reports throughout the app that they're depressed or they've had suicidal thoughts, we immediately stop in the app and put up the national hotline, suicide hotline, and ask them if they would like to be contacted. And then we would contact them and connect them to the resource. We have found that most users don't ask us to contact them. They say to us that the reason they put in that they're suicidal is because they feel safe providing that information, and that if they need help, that they will reach out, or that they already are talking to somebody. So, but there are places where we just prioritize safety and health above them using the app, and we'll and just have built in the, those mechanisms. And I think, you know, around the world, we can think about how we do that. But that really does require partnering with local experts around what are those resources, because certainly there's not a national suicide line in all countries or a domestic violence hotline. But there are other resources. I just think we have to be creative in thinking through them.
So are our guests optimistic about the future? Is the ethical review system serving women and girls? Are we sufficiently protecting everyone involved in the research process?
Am I optimistic? Yes. I have a historical perspective. So I do think that even if the progress is slow and we still have a very long way to go, you know, when I think of where we were when we started this work, I think we've definitely come a long way. And I think in terms of the ethical reviews, I think at the beginning, there was a lot of resistance to doing research in this area because of a valid concern from many IRBs that these are very vulnerable women, that, you know, we may be putting them at risk, etc. So knowing that we can do this in a way that is safe and that is ethical and that we're not putting women at risk, I think is something that we can say we know how to do it. I mean, it doesn't mean that everyone does it, and we still hear some bad practices like, you know, interviewing men and women from the same household, for example, which for us is an absolute no-no. You know, if you want to do a study on men, which many people now increasingly want to do, make sure you use a different sample and etc. If you want to add a violence module to a survey on, I don't know, income or livelihoods or whatever, make sure that you do integrate the ethical and safety guidelines for this particular aspect, you know, and this is something we are really stressing. You know, we really had to argue a lot with the demographic and health survey people at the beginning, and now they are super diligent about doing it like this. So I think there is a lot more awareness and willingness to take these issues on board. There are still some bad practices, and I think we have to always be vigilant. And then just the last point, you know, we really want to think very carefully about how do we bring in survivors. There's a lot of issues around representativity, you know, how do you select people, you know, ensuring that it's an equal relationship, you know, do you pay them? All of these issues that are not straightforward necessarily, but obviously very important to ensure that the voices of survivors are there from the early stages in the design of the research and even identifying research priorities as we're doing. But again, we feel that it needs some kind of guidance and maybe some tools to facilitate this. So this is an area where we are doing some work this year, and hopefully we'll have something to share at the end of the year on this aspect.
I am optimistic.
I love that.
Yeah, I'm an optimistic person.
Yeah.
I do think that the global community of advocates and researchers have done a tremendous job in educating our ethics committees, in working and developing capacity to challenge researchers and programs that are delivering services to women, that they can challenge these services and call out behavior that is puts women at risk. You know, there's always more work to be done. You know, the focus on trauma-informed care and the focus of integrating that into our ethics programs, especially, you know, those that go out in the field and collect this information are often women who have tremendous amount of responsibility in their own homes, in their communities, and they're hearing some of the worst stories, and they go home and carry out their day-to-day responsibilities. So integrating more support in our ethics for women for self-care, integrating into our programs, I think is a really key point. And I'm just looking at sort of the issues in our country around leadership in the U.S. now, with so few women in leadership positions in our Congress, in our boardrooms. And I think that that's true on ethics committee. We've got to increase the number of women who are informing these ethic committees and educating, you know, their colleagues about the importance of this work and the strategies that are being used successfully to engage women and children in work to prevent and reduce violence.
I am also optimistic. I think that as a field, we've really come a long way. There was a time where it was really committees were really not wanting to hear anything about this work and saying it cannot be done and all that. But I think that over the years, we've shown that it really can be done, and it can be done ethically, and it can be done in a way that is safe for women and girls, and that the researchers have demonstrated, you know, a very strong conviction of providing, you know, not only collecting information from women and girls, but also providing, you know, much needed support, having really direct benefit, you know, being accrued by research by women and girls who participate in our research, and really the issue of referral, you know, ensuring that they access services and all that. So I am really optimistic, but I think I take the point as well that was shared by Nancy about really ensuring that more women get into these ethics committees so that they can really, you know, begin to you know, educate the other ethics committee members, which I'm often, you know, men who are sitting in these committees and who have legal understanding of gender, gender-based violence and violence against women in, you know, in its broad sense. But also, Lisa, another point that I wanted to make is that there has been a lot of investment that has been done by NIH and other funders to fund, you know, research ethics trainings in the Global South in Africa. And we have big training projects in South Africa, for example, who accessible to, you know, accessed by researchers and academics from, you know, all over Africa who come to take this course either in person or virtually. And this has also helped to capacitate ethics committees in other countries as well.
Thanks to our guests, Claudia Garcia Moreno, Nancy Glass, and Yandisa Skuyia, for joining us on the podcast. I am Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I am Angelica Pino. You have been listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast by the SVRI. To find out more about our vision, visit svri.org.
To free the world of violence against women and violence against children, we need everyone to hear our message. So please subscribe, like, and review us on Apple Podcasts, and do share this episode far and wide.
This is the final episode of Series 1 of the podcast. Thank you so much for listening and for being a part of our show. And keep an eye out for news of Series 2. Bye for now.
Bye.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.